Good morning, everyone. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee meeting to order. Just a little bit of housekeeping. We have the omnibus pension bill in front of us today. We also have several other bills on the agenda. The hope is that we could finish everything by the time we have to, by about 12:30, which is when the next committee would come in to meet, which I believe is civil law. If not, we will have to come back after session this evening, whenever that time wraps up. But I'll do my best to kind of keep the ship on track, but if the conversations dictate and we need to continue after session, we will. With that, Representative O'Driscoll, welcome to the committee with the omnibus pension bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what I'd like to first of all do is move the 12A amendment to House File 1508. 1508 is going to be what we refer to around the legislature as the vehicle bill for the pensions bill for 2015. And the 12A amendment represents the work almost in totality that was done by the Pensions Commission. And so, Mr. Chair, as a member of the committee, I will move the 12A amendment this morning to House File 1508.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the 12A as an author's amendment. But before we do that, Representative O'Driscoll, let's move the actual House file so the bill is in front of us.
Mr. Chair, excellent idea. I'd like to move House File 1508 before the Government Operations Committee.
Representative O'Driscoll moves House File 1508 to the Committee on State Government Finance. And Representative O'Driscoll moves the 12A as an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape that he wishes. All in favor of the 12A, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? 12A is adopted.
And, Mr. Chair, to the best of my knowledge, I am the only owner of amendments, and if it's your will at this point, I'd like to take those amendments so that we could get the bill in the shape that we need for the committee at this point. A couple of them are technical corrections as we deal with the pensions bill and dealing with a number of new players who are involved in this. We are continually revising language on this. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the 13A amendment to House File 1508. In summary, what this does is addresses a few of the technical amendments that we have relative to pensions language that is no longer or is antiquated in our state statutes as a result of some updates and some mergers that would be taking place as a result of previous legislative action. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move an author's amendment for 13A to House File 1508.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the 13A. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. The 13A amendment, page 9, line 1.3, section 6, what does that do? It looks like that's a single person section that was put in, or is that, what does that do? I mean, is it, when you say it's getting rid of obsolete language, is that affecting anybody, or?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I think I'm now on page 9, so do restate your.
Section story. 6 would be page 9, 910 to 927, section 6 that you're deleting.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, if we take a look at this, I will ask Rachel Thurlow from the Pensions and Retirements Committee, our commission, to come forward just to make sure that I don't misspeak on any of this. But I do believe that this is a redundant reference to some other information that's in here. But I'm going to ask her to share that with us. And if she's unable to, I think that this amendment also came from the folks at PERA, which covers the folks that would be in the Metropolitan Transit Commission. So with that, Mr. Chair, I have Ms. Thurlow.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Thurlow. If you would just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rachel Thurlow, and I am the acting director of the Pension Commission. And Representative Nelson, this is part of, so when the reviser went through and consolidated and tried to put together all the articles, she found that this section was already being repealed elsewhere in Mr. Martin's original 1508 bill, which kind of cleaned up obsolete language. And he had determined that, yes, although this did apply to one employee, it is no longer, they must have already satisfied it. It's from 1978, and he realized that it was obsolete and out of date and no longer needed to be in the statute books.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I need to know. Thank you.
All in favor of the 13A amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wishes. Please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other amendment that I have this morning that I'd like to discuss before the commission is the A15-0526 amendment. Mr. Chair, there will also be a verbal amendment to this at this time. In working in concert with Ms. Thurlow's office and with the folks at PERA, we do not believe that the language and some of the stakeholders at this time are a little uncomfortable with the language. Since we've missed the deadline for this committee, we do have alternative language that may be offered at some time, but since we did miss the deadline, we are not planning to offer alternative language, and we'll end up having to work with that at a future stop of this bill. So I want to go ahead and amend that language. So members, if you take a look at the A15-0526 amendment, starting on line 15, I'll get it in the shape that we want, and then I'll explain to you what this amendment does. Starting on line 1.5, supplemental contribution of the employing entity's share, the words that remain is the larger of either colon should be struck, and in its place, the word of should be added. On line 1.6, deleting the number 1 in parentheses, and then at the end of that, the semicolon and the word or deleted, and in its place, a period inserted. So when it's corrected, it should read, for the period of July 1st, 2015 through December 31st of 2013, supplemental contribution of the employing unit's share of $21 million. Then lines 1.7 through the conclusion of lines 1.3, that entire section can be struck. And what this section does is, one of the provisions that we'll talk about in the bill today is that MERF, the Minneapolis Employer Retirement Fund, was merged about 4 or 5 years ago into the PERA plan. And as a result of that merger, the 80% funding level has been reached, so MERF by statute no longer exists. One of the concerns that some of the stakeholder groups had, including PERA, was that the 3,400 plus members of that MERF group are mostly retired. The vast majority, 99.5 or better percent of the folks, are retired. There's a question and a concern that deals with tracking those individuals and making sure that the amount of funds that are collected help to support that integration of those without diluting the entire PERA general board or funding level. As I had said, we're striking this language because there's some problems with it. We do have some additional language that we will look at a future stop since we missed the deadline. Mr. Chair, I believe that Representative Nelson might have a question.
First, we'll go to Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative O'Driscoll and Ms. Thurlow, I just have a technical point, and we didn't get a chance to discuss this before the meeting, but Representative O'Driscoll, if you look at lines 199.25 and 199.26 of the bill of the 12A amendment. Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, 199.25 and 199.26. It already says in the bill exactly what we're getting back to by amending your amendment. It says that for the period July 1, 2015 until December 31, 2031, the employer's supplemental contribution is the... So I don't think we need the top part of the amendment is what I'm getting at.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
In the words of Ferris Bueller, I like it when a plan comes together. Mr. Chair, you're exactly right. The language that we have amended in the amendment is exactly the same language that is in here. So in essence, lines 1.3 through 1.13 could be deleted, and we're left with just a short portion of this at the bottom, and I will explain to that as well. And I know that Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, had a question, I thought, as well.
Okay, so just so we are clear, though, on the A15, basically, you would like to... divide the amendment, and then we would just take up lines 1.14 through 1.17.
Mr. Chair, if I understood Mr. Shepherd correctly, the 1.14, or excuse me, the 1.4 line through 1.16, as we had are attempting to orally amend this, is exactly the same language that this amendment was to look at, because we added the other portion here. So by striking that entire portion of 1.3 through 1.13, it brings it back to the original language. So that whole portion is not necessary.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, yeah.
Representative Nelson.
I think Mr. Shepherd just said the same thing. Yeah, Representative Driscoll's modifying his amendment to delete 1.3 to 1.13 from the amendment, and then just the amendment would be line 1.14 to 1.17. I think that's what Mr. Shepherd just told you in your ear. The only other point I was going to make out is that when Representative Driscoll read it, and maybe it was a little bit of dyslexia, but he said December 31st, 2013, and it's 2031, and I just wanted to point that out so the tape is corrected.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Okay, so Representative O'Driscoll modifies his amendment, and we will be deleting lines 1.3 through lines 1.13. All the members...
Well, Mr. Chair, I think there's somebody who wants to speak to that. No, I guess not. No, he's...
Mr. Chair, the only...
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move that, if you want to take the oral amendment, and then I'll also explain what 1.14 through 1.7 does, and then we can just move forward.
What? Go ahead and do that. You've modified your amendment, so no further action needs to be taken on that part.
The lines 1.14 through 1.17 deal with something that the Pension Commission was looking at in the way of restructuring the PERA board to include a... Excuse me. This will strike the language in these lines. It strikes the language in the in Article 14 and Section 66, Subdivision B, that the state's contribution ends if PERA's general is fully funded. And maybe Ms. Thurlow could explain a little bit additional background if members would like to discuss that.
Ms. Thurlow?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would actually ask if Shana Jones from PERA could come and explain this one, since they specifically requested it.
Welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself for the record, let us know who you represent.
Mr. Chair, as she's doing that, I appreciate the indulgence of the committee. This is a process where we're working with a lot of moving parts.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brumbeck.
Could we confirm what page we're on, please?
Yep, we're on page 203 in the bill.
Mr. Chair, members, Shana Jones, I'm the policy director at PERA. The lines 1.14 through 1.17 are seeking to delete some language that we think is a carryover from the language that was initially in there when MRF was a separate division. When MRF was a separate division, the state's payment was set to click off if the MRF account reached 100% funding. We think that that makes perfect sense. If MRF had enough money, then payments would cease. So the way that it got translated, it appears in Mr. Martin's bill, is that it would also trigger off when the general plan reaches 100% funding. And we don't think that that was the intent. If it triggered off before 2031, now that MRF is fully merged with PERA, we could have a subsidization effect happening. And I think it was just an oversight on Mr. Martin's part, because he saw MRF division and struck it and put in general plan instead.
Okay, thank you for the explanation. Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, could we have Chamber Harry from Minneapolis who worked on this Jean Ranieri from Minneapolis, who worked on this whole merger, testify regarding this? Because there's a lot of technicalities on this and a lot of agreements that were reached based on things.
Thank you, Representative Mullery. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would just introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the City of Minneapolis. Representative Mullery, into question, what this language that now stands, based on the amendment with all the changes, would be in conformance or conform to what the Pension Commission did a couple weeks ago in terms of the contribution from the local governments and the state. It would be $16 million from the state and $21 million from the local contribution. What it also does is have the state pay till 2031. And it has the state also contribute to 2031, right, rather than have a early out date.
Representative Mulery.
Mr. Chair, I know what happened at the Pension Commission.
Okay.
I'm wondering about the last 1.14 to 1.17. Is that in accord with your understanding of this whole thing that's gone on over the years?
Mr. Ranieri.
Mr. Chairman, this is to Representative Mulery's question, this is a modification of the contribution levels of the state and local governments. Prior to it, state was at $24 million as a max. These local employers were at $27 million as a minimum. However, with the new evaluation, actual evaluation, the number came down, and the split in terms of proportion is a little different than it was before.
Representative Mulery.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ranieri, apparently I'm not asking the question right. I'm not asking about that. I'm asking about the language in 203.34 through basically what we're doing is striking all of 203.34 through, are we not? Through 204.6 or something. It's regarding taking out Murph Division in maybe you or Mr. Shepard could explain what's happening in that language, and I just wanted to know if that's your understanding of the whole agreement you guys spent so long putting together.
Mr. Ranieri.
Mr. Chairman, I think it is, Mr. Chairman. I think it is I understand as being our agreement.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, one more correction. I know when Representative O'Driscoll originally talked about this, he talked about the merger before, and it really wasn't a merger. It was PARA taking over administration of the MRF plan until it got to the 80% that it is now. They aren't actually physically merged. It was, in the past, we just got rid of the MRF board and PARA took over. They didn't merge before. They're merging now. I just want to make sure that's
Mr. Ranieri.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. The merger actually, we reached the 80% threshold, I think, in August of 2014.
Excellent. Seeing no further discussion, we will vote on the A15 as modified by Representative O'Driscoll. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, there's one last amendment and it gets the bill in the form that we're looking at, and the discussion probably will be short on the entire bill because these are the areas that probably have some question on it. The A14 amendment is something that reinstates some work that the Pension Commission had done in the original bill that's before us, the 12A amendment that we just adopted. There was some discussion at the Pension Commission about making sure that the group of MRF employees retired, which is about 3,400, and there's only about 40 active members who are still working and paying in under this plan, would have fair and adequate representation on the MRF board. With some 90,000 persons in the PERA covered sphere, with 3,400, the commission had acknowledged that MRF being represented would be a good thing. There are some caveats that were on that the PERA board would need to be weighing in on this, and others may want to offer opinion on this. But what the A14 amendment does is, in essence, undoes the work of the Pension Commission by adding a special seat on the PERA board for a population that is less than 0.5% of all PERA members. This has not been done previously when other groups have been consolidated or administratively brought into the PERA board, nor was this something that was put forward at the time that PERA took over last year, the Duluth teachers' pension. And so this would be something that would be very unique for a very small group of people. The Senate has already heard this, and the Senate has taken the language out of their version of the bill. I'm advocating that we do the same. And PERA has weighed in on this after a special meeting and talking about some of the administrative challenges on this. And so what we'd like to do is to certainly allow, as the MRF members would be able to put someone forward for the seats that are available. The governor certainly has the ability to appoint as well. And if there was a need or a desire, the governor could appoint somebody from the MRF population if the governor felt that the MRF population wasn't properly being represented on the 11-member board as it's currently stands. So it basically repeals and takes that seat out and puts it back into current language. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Move the H1508-14A. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wonder if there's anybody here that's from the former MRF or that could give some some insight into this, because I saw this in there. It made kind of sense to me, having served on the Pension Commission in the past. And I think Mr. Johnson's moving down to the mic just to make sure that they're on board with this, because I don't know, like I said, I don't know whose bill. This must have been an original bill from somebody. I don't know, or maybe it came from the Pension Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Dave Johnson. I'm a partner at Fagry Baker Daniels, and I represent the Minneapolis Municipal Retirement Association. Just by way of background and why we had concerns and felt that we needed representation on the board, that requires a little bit of the history of MRF and a little bit of what's happened and a little bit of our concerns about what's going on in this bill. So if that's okay, I can give a little
a
bit
brief
of
the history. Yeah. Mr. Johnson.
There's not a brief history of MRF, Mr. Chairman.
Make one up.
But I will try the brief history. The brief history is this is in 2008, 2009, the fund was between 3 and 5 years from going bankrupt. There was a negotiation between the retirees, the state of Minnesota, and the employers about how to make the fund solvent. The state of Minnesota participated not as a bailout, but because they were the employer of record. And had responsibility for making contributions that they didn't make, and they made the decision to close MRF and didn't provide for the legacy costs. We reached an agreement. That mechanism has worked. It's worked very well, so much for that we hit 80% funding. And in December of this year, the former MRF director suggested, because of all the outstanding issues, that the current funding mechanism be continued for 2 years, and folks could spend the interim coming up with a new mechanism that a new mechanism that looked at new actuarial work, that looked at mortality tables, that looked at the market correction that everybody thought was going to happen or is concerned is going to happen, and looked at a number of other factors. During the course of the Pension Commission, that was changed. New actuarial work was done that we did not get a chance to review. And I would just say I've done 4 or 5 of these consolidations, and almost always the actuarial work is vetted. There, as folks who've served on the commission know, the actuarial or the pension commission vets that, looks at it. There's discussion about it at the commission level. Everybody can review it, and everybody can ask questions. We didn't get to see the actuarial work till after the Pension Commission made a decision to cut the funding. And so we have a number of concerns about the process. We have a number of concerns about some of the things that we saw in the actuarial work, which included a statement by the actuary that the 8% assumption was too high given the aged population of MRF. MRF members, there's about 3,800 of them. They don't get Social Security. Their average pension is in the 22,000, and They agreed and participated by giving them taking a very reduced COLA that's going to erode their pension over time to contribute about $130 million to fixing this problem. So those are all the concerns we had, and that led us to want to have somebody on the board, because thinking this could be solved in the near term, it looks like it'll at least be till 2031, and there continue to be questions on our part. And we feel like we haven't been part of this process, and that we have been left out of the process, and we've contributed to the solution. And so this may not be the best approach, and we'll look at other things, but I wanted people to have an understanding of where we're at with respect to what's going on MRF funding, and what led us to want to have more involvement, because we feel like we've contributed, and we feel like this is going to undo MRF. And until And given the process that has occurred and the fact that we haven't been part of it and the fact that we can't ask questions about it is very concerning to us. So hopefully we'll get some chances to continue to talk about that and get more comfortable with the actuarial work, but that's why we were for it, but we don't oppose this amendment at this time.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to piggyback on something that Mr. Johnson had said, he had shared the same concerns at the Pension Commission, and what we did is we had the actuarial work that was done by PERA to come up with the reduced numbers and the revised payments. Had that reviewed by Deloitte, the independent actuary, and I realize I'm getting very wonky for a lot of folks, but we have their work reviewed by the independent, meaning that they do not work for any particular plan or any particular fund. They work for the legislature to oversee and to look at these, and we have documentation that's come back from them that says the split that, $37 million that, and I know this is the Finance Committee, but the $37 million that was referenced by Mr. Johnson is a sound and actuarially sound number. So I know that some of those concerns that he had have been addressed. We did hear those and move forward on those. So we're continuing with that process.
Mr. Johnson.
Can I just make clear for the record, we haven't seen that actuarial work. What we saw was when we walked in the door, a one-page handout, and a couple of the things that we saw in that handout raise as many questions as they solve. So hopefully we'll get a chance to review that work at some point. But it's important to understand that generally the Pension Commission lets people review this stuff before they make funding decisions. Thank you. And like I said, we don't oppose this amendment.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, do you have something to say to this point?
Mr. Chairman, members, Keith Carlson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that represents other employees that participate in PERA, and I think certainly the non-union employees, and I think the union employees of our employers too on this. We support this amendment right now for the committee's knowledge. Currently, the board is an 11-member board. Six of those members either represent unions or the retirees. This would create a seventh member. There are only three employer representatives on the board right now, and then the state auditor and an at-large member of the public. So we're concerned about the further overweighting of representations of the employee retiree side if this amendment was not acted on affirmatively.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Seeing no further member questions, we will vote on the -14A amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wishes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. With that, Representative O'Driscoll, we should be through all of the amendments to the DE that's in front of us. And with that, members, just want to make sure that we stick closely to a policy discussion here. This will be going to state government finance later on from there. But Representative O'Driscoll, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, on behalf of the Pension Commission, I want to thank you for hearing the bill today. I can go article by article and section by section, but I will spare you unless you have some specifics that you'd like to visit and just give you a general overview. The bill has four categories, generally speaking. One is some technical correction information that MSRS, TRA, PERA, and the St. Paul Teachers Group tend to bring forward periodically for statutory revisions. Those are any non-controversial, passed unanimously by members of the commission. The second section of information there deals with some changes in the actuarial assumption and the rate of return that we'd be looking at. We have been temporarily moved from 8.5% to 8%. The commission is recommending that we go from 8.5% to 8% on a permanent basis. More actuarial information and data will be available after we are done with session. That in the interim, the Pension Commission will be taking a look at and considering for future action and what needs to be done, if anything, and to what degree. The only group that is not going from 8.5% to 8% right now is the TRA group, the Teacher Retirement Association. And part of that is they have an actuarial review that's coming up after the session is done, and the others have had information that supported the move from 8.5% to 8%. And out of deference to the process, we are agreeing that we will wait to go from 8.5% to 8% on the TRA fund until such time that we get additional information on that. Also, in statute, we have mechanisms in place that as the state pension plans move in level of funding from their current status to an 80 to a 90% funding, that COLAs will trigger on. We also have, through board approval at the various fund levels, agreement that if we fall below those funding levels, that the COLAs will point off. So, for example, if we are at 90%, which would drive a 2% COLA, and we fall below that for the prescribed period of time, that would blink down to a 1%. If we fall below 80%, that will then blink off to a 1% or to zero. So the blink ons and the blink offs are both in statute at this point, which have been brought forward with the approval of the various boards from the pensions. The other area that, two areas, is we oftentimes will have members who have folks in their districts, whether they be senators or whether they be House members, who for various reasons might have, if I can use the term, fallen through the cracks where they weren't properly tracked. Administratively, the pensions can't do anything with it, which takes legislative action. There are a number of bipartisan supported across the state corrections that are in here. Again, all of these provisions have been unanimously approved by the Pension Commission to be brought forward this year. We had no dissenting votes on anything that went into this provision. The other area that the Pension Commission has jurisdiction over would be volunteer fire relief associations. There's some administrative corrections here. There are also some provisions to allow for some unwinding of particular pensions. One is in the city of Roseville, where it will be a retired member board versus an active member board because they are now moving under PERA administration, and there's some residual folks that will need to be on their individual board. Unwinding of other fire departments that would allow for money to be moved from one pension relief association to another as they become successor firefighters in a different city because that entity that they were working for no longer exists. And so, Mr. Chair, the other item was that of the MRF that we were talking about. I think we've clearly vetted some of the questions and issues on that. Another provision in here to remove from statute language that referred to MRF, since it is merged into the PERA at this point as a result of reaching the 80% funding level that Representative Nelson has spoken about. So with that, Mr. Chair, I stand for questions.
Thank you very much, Representative O'Driscoll, and thank you for all the work that you've done on this bill to get it in front of us today. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm speaking with Representative Murphy. During the discussion on the MRF and lowering the amount of money that we're putting in there, and I know this borders on the funding piece of it, but it's also policy. There was discussion, and because of the lateness of the actuarial thing report coming in, of maintaining the money going in there that we were putting in. I think it's a $16 million cut in what the state's paying into the state and the plans are paying into there, of paying that for an additional year to make sure that it was there and allowing the funds to get paid off quicker or up to 100% funding quicker and allowing them to then the state's money going in there, the extra money going there would go away. So, I mean, that's a policy discussion that we should look at. I mean, that's the faster these are paid off, it's like paying your mortgage off on your house early. You save money over the long term if we can pay those down and eliminate that extra, or eliminate those extra payments for the state quicker.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nelson, for raising that issue. That is one of the reasons why I think the Pension Commission is in place, is to look at those more global policy issues, and that's something that I would respectfully defer to the Pension Commission for conversation and discussion, bring back the respective chambers on how to look at that. And Representative Murphy did raise that issue. We've never done that in the past, and then the question becomes, that $16 million savings, where does that go? Do we allocate that out to each of the pensions that are underfunded? Do we pick one favorite over another? Where do we go? And so there's many policy decisions, I think, that in discussions that need to center around that conversation before we can go ahead and make a firm decision on that.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I understand that policy decision, but it's the question gets to be at some point, there's going to be a market correction. And when I did my taxes this year, my accountant said that he's been predicting it for the last 3 years that there's going to be a major market correction. And thankfully, he's been wrong. And thankfully, because he's been wrong, it's helped our pension plans, all of them across the board, get their funding levels up. But at some point, there is going to be another downturn in the market. And when that happens, we may have to revisit putting more money into the pensions. And with this MRF one, if we had left that extra money going in there, it might have helped PARA and MRF get to the point where they're 100% funded. And again, at that point, our contributions to them could cease, and those extra money could then stay in our general fund budgets.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, a couple of things on that. Some of the corrections that are in revisions that are being offered in the bill today also help to be able to shore up the solvency of the pensions. When we talk about the blink ons and blink offs and some of those kinds of things that have been agreed upon by the plans, that also helps to keep it solvent, market correction notwithstanding, but to build a more solid base for those pensionees that we, as the state of Minnesota, have pledged to take care of. To the other issue that was raised by Representative Nelson about paying in advance on some of these things, same thing happened for MRF that happened last year for Duluth. Some best numbers were looked at to use in state money. The same thing that happened to MRF will happen to the Duluth plan. We'll get an actuarial evaluation on there to find out how close we are, too high, too low, just right on those. And that's just kind of the nature of the pensions business, and we'll just deal with those things as we go through and we come across in real time.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Any other member questions or discussion? Representative Rembeck.
Mr. Chair, just a really quick comment. First of all, thanks for your great leadership and expertise on this issue, Representative. And I think it's worthy of mention that still the feeling of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence, which I think does do their homework, is that we still have a lot of fiscal illusion that's permeating our pension system, and it's important to get the numbers right and aiming more towards solvency.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative Rembeck, your observations are very noteworthy that we do need to do a lot more educating of a lot of people in the legislature and a lot of people in the state of Minnesota on pension-related issues and alternatives and options. And I want to thank my predecessors who, when they brought forward some of the provisions that today are in this bill, you thought that we set their hair on fire and sent them running through the hallways that the world was going to end. As we start doing more educating and working on that, people came to a comfort level. And I would be the first to admit that there is more work that needs to be done in the way of education and reforms, but we are getting there, and it's really nice to be able to work with people who are wanting to get around the table and take a closer look at those things. So, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Seeing no further member questions or discussion, thank you, committee, for a good discussion on this. This is one of the most important things that we deal with in this committee as well. And again, thank you again, Representative O'Driscoll, for your work on the Pension Commission and bringing the bill forward. With that, we'll turn it back over to you for a final comment and to move your bill.
Mr. Chair, I will dispense with any final comments because we did take a lot of committee time on this, and I would ask members to support House File 1508 as amended. Do we refer to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration?
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Next on the agenda, we have House File 2215, Representative Hancock. And while he's coming to the table, can I have a motion on the minutes, Representative Nash?
Mr. Chair, I wanted to make a motion for the minutes for April 16th to be approved.
Representative Nash moves the minutes from our previous meeting on April 16th. Any discussion to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Representative Hancock, welcome to the Government Operations Committee. I'll go ahead and move your bill, House File 2215, to be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be back in front of the first committee I served on a few years ago. What you have before you today is House File 2215. Basically, it requires the Board of Soil and Water Conservation to identify high-priority areas for wetland replacement. It allows for local government recommendations in the process, and the reason it's before you is it does exempt this designation from the rulemaking requirements. And it says that they will become effective 30 days after publication in the state register.
Thank you, Representative Hancock. Sir, welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself, let us know who you represent.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is David Wyrens. I'm an assistant director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'll probably just say a few remarks and then turn over to the committee for any questions you may have. The language you have before you is part of a process that the board's been leading for over a year with many stakeholders who are engaged in wetland protection and management in the state of Minnesota. One of the areas that we've been trying to work on is how do we improve the location of replacement wetlands for projects that impact wetlands. And this the approach that Representative Hancock had briefly discussed is one way to, in fact, do that is go through a process to designate areas of the state that have a greater public value in terms of providing environmental benefits to the areas that these wetlands would be located. The purpose of the exempt rulemaking process really is twofold. The first is to allow us to identify these areas and make them available to the public and to folks engaged in wetland activities across the state within a shorter rulemaking process. But then on a longer-term basis, we do intend to include process and criteria in rulemaking that, of course, takes roughly 2 years to complete. But we still want to be able to adjust and modify these high priority areas in times going forward and run those through the board that makes decisions for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. With that brief overview, Mr. Chair and committee members, we'd be happy to respond to any questions you may have.
Thank you for your comments, sir. Any member questions or discussion? Seeing none, is there anyone else that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Hancock will give you the final words.
Thank you. Could you use your support?
Thank you, Representative Hancock. With that, I will renew my motion, the House File 2215, to refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, House File 2054, Representative Torkelson. Welcome to the committee, Chair Torkelson. And I will go ahead and move House File 2054 to the General Register. To your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2054 is an excerpt from the Clean Water Fund bill that is already part of the legacy bill. It involves the membership of the Clean Water Council that has been in place since 2006. The bill would actually take two of the current voting members of the council and put them as a part of the non-voting members of the council. The council has both voting and non-voting members. The voting members represent a number of statewide groups. The non-voting members are the legislative members and the members that represent various state agencies. The reasoning behind this, Mr. Chair and members, is that both the Met Council and the University of Minnesota are really more closely related to state agencies and their perspective on this council. And in fact, both of those groups do receive some direct funds from the Clean Water Fund. So to avoid the perception of conflict of interest and to make the council a little more representative of how it actually works, I'm suggesting this change.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Any member questions or discussions to this bill? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson. It looks like you're taking members off or you're taking voting rights away from members on the council that have more of a scientific background and maybe more expertise. And while they'll still be members of the council, by taking their vote away, it looks like you're moving this away from actually protecting waters than what it's supposed to do is make sure the waters we have in the state are clean.
Chair Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. I would disagree with that quite strongly. There's no requirement that either of these seats be scientific in nature. They represent the two organizations, the University of Minnesota and the Metropolitan Council. The other thing that's changed since the council was first put together is that kind of in parallel to the council, there is a group called the Interagency Working Group that involves all of the state agencies that are represented on the council. And in fact, both of these organizations, the University of Minnesota and the Met Council, are part of that interagency working group. So they're really, in my mind, kind of getting a double bite at the apple, so to speak. because they sit on both sides of this, or both of these organizations that are involved with making suggestions to for the funding or for the spending of the Clean Water Fund. The interagency working group seems to have more of a direct line to the governor, whereas the council has more of a direct line to the legislature. So it just to me, it seems like it's going to work better if these divisions are more brightly defined, shall we say, so that we know exactly what these folks are up to. As far as the discussions of the council, there's very seldom any votes that are actually divided, shall we say. Most of the council's action is taken by consensus. In fact, I can't think of a time when the council had a divided vote, although I don't attend every minute of every meeting myself. But as I said earlier, both of these organizations have received direct funding from the Clean Water Fund, and for those two reasons, I think this is the right thing to do.
Representative Nelson, a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not convinced, but I know that's disagreements and difference of opinions are what the world's made of, so I'm not going to be supporting the bill, but I appreciate Representative Torkelson's opinion and his belief.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I would say there's no intention to decrease the amount of scientific knowledge brought before this council. They depend on lots of testimony from lots of various scientific representatives that do bring their scientific knowledge to the council and make presentations on a regular basis.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Shetnin. If you would just introduce yourself.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetnin. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and thank you for the opportunity to speak here this morning. I'd just like to point out the council has some concern with this bill. The council, as Representative Torkelson has expressed, we are currently a member of the Clean Water Council with voting rights. We are different from state agencies where we do some of the research and development work that the other agencies don't, and we'd like to continue to have a conversation with Representative Torkelson to maybe be able to talk a little bit about the differences between the university and the council and the agencies. But at this point, we just want to express our concerns, and we'll continue to speak with him about that.
Thank you, Mr. Shetnin. Chair Torkelson.
I would add one other point of information for transparency's sake. As far as the Met Council goes, they do not have the same person as a voting member as they have as a member of the interagency working group. They are two different people, but they are represented on both organizations.
Thank you. Any other member questions or discussion? Seeing none, Representative Torkelson, we'll give you the last word.
Just appreciate your hearing this bill today, Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2054 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next on the agenda, we have House File 2235, Representative Albright. Welcome to the committee, Representative Albright. I know this bill came to us from Commerce where we had a really good discussion. And for the purposes of our discussion today, we want to make sure we highlight Subdivision 8, which is rulemaking on page 4. With that, we'll let you move the bill and introduce it.
Mr. Chair, I move House File 2235 to be before the committee. Members, this is the purview of this committee by virtue of Subdivision 8 to the work compensation insurance legislation that is historic in nature. The gentleman sitting to my right, your left, Commissioner Ken Peterson, will give testimony to a 10-year process of a marathon, if you will, that has brought together a fairly significant number of stakeholders, all whom have a great and a varied degree of inclusion in the final product. And I think that he'll remark on those and thank those members for their participation in a long-standing but very fruitful process that will candidly produce great benefits not only for businesses but also for labor. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will refer my remarks to the Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. And what this bill is, it's what it does is moves to a new way of handling hospital work comp costs from the present system of 85% of usual and customary charges to a Medicare-based, a Medicare DRG system, which we believe that on a yearly basis will save somewhere between 15 and 16, 17% of hospital costs for the workers' comp system. It's a product of, as Representative Albright said, the product of over 10 years of negotiations and discussions, and there are a number of people very involved with it, including several people like David Olson, former head of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, who passed away, worked very hard in this, and my former deputy commissioner, Chris Iden, also passed away. What it does is bring down the cost, and all the various parties to the system, labor and business, and more importantly, or more detail-wise, hospitals and insurers have agreed to it after a long period of negotiations and data collection, and they've come to an agreement that this is the way to go for the future. And was approved by the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, which I think most of you are familiar with, which is composed equally of representatives from management and representatives of labor, as well as two representatives from each house, from the House of Representatives, our Representative Albright and Representative Mahoney, both of them did a very good job on this one, encouraging people to come to a solution. Anyway, all the parties have agreed to it. We didn't come to an agreement, however, until the morning of our last meeting on April 7th, and so we did go over the deadline, which is why we're here today as opposed to being here before your earlier deadline. And we will be appearing before the Rules Committee and hopefully working out something with them. However, but the thing that's important for your purposes today is part of the agreement was that there be expedited rulemaking for two areas. One is that in the event for implementation of this bill, in the event that Medicare makes any changes over the next, before the legislature meets next year, before January 1st when the bill goes into effect, then we want expedited rulemaking to accommodate ourselves to the Medicare changes, which we, as you probably all may have seen, that Medicare just passed a new Medicare law yesterday, and they're always doing new rules and stuff, so we may have to need expedited rulemaking for that. The second reason, though, was part of the agreement that we came to for the hospitals was that over the next year we negotiate agreement for non-hospital outpatient services provided by ambulatory surgical centers and also by hospital outpatient stuff. That amounts to about 75% of the total work comp medical bill, and so the hospitals account for about 25%. But so the agreement was over the next year that the insurer, the payers in the form of the insurers as well as the providers come to an agreement. However, if they are unable to come to an agreement, and this is where the expedited rulemaking comes in, that the department do rules that would accomplish the same thing by January 1st, 2017. So we hope that it's in some ways an incentive, in some ways it's a gun to the head, saying if you guys don't come to an agreement, then the department will have to take the necessary steps working with the various parties to do rulemaking itself if you're unable to come to agreement. So that was part of the agreement that we had for the other bill, was that we have an incentive for people to come to an agreement with the outpatient stuff. And so that'll bring down the cost for both sides. And once again, I want to emphasize this was backed by both the management and labor representatives. Here today, on behalf of the chamber, is Ben Gerber. Labor was not able to be here today, but if you want to hear from them, they're certainly available. But all parties did agree to it. This bill has been vetted thoroughly. I assure you of that. Every sentence, every word, every dotted I, every cross T has been looked at. This has been a very well-scrutinized bill.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Albright. And having served on the Workers' Comp Advisory Board, this is the bill from the Workers' Comp Advisory Board is my first question. I think you said that, but I just want to make sure.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, yes. In fact, the very nature of the bill arriving here is because of the hard work that Commissioner Peterson and both management and labor culminated in just a couple of weeks ago.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Peterson, will this take, when I first meeting I had when I was on the Workers' Comp Advisory Board, I got my ear filled with a management representative, a plant owner from southern Minnesota, a business owner from southern Minnesota, that complained that if he has an employee break their arm off out of work and the health insurance covers it, it costs $200, where that same employee breaks their arm and on the job site, that it was costing him 10 times as much, and that will this help get at some of those disparities in cost? Is that what this does?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Just in short, it does. Does not bring it as to make them fully compatible, but brings them much closer.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a brother-in-law that I have that used to be a controller for a health clinic talked about that when I first got on the Workers' Comp Advisory Board many years ago, they had to have one person for all their hospital claims, and they had to have six people to deal with the paperwork for their workers' comp claims that they helped deal with, and it's just the length of time it got. Is this going to help deal with some of those issues?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson. Yes, the sweet spot here was that it brings down the costs for insurers. On the other hand, for hospitals, it makes things much faster. It'll do away with a number of the disputes. It makes the bills must be paid quicker and eliminates a number of the disputes. And so I would think that your brother-in-law, if he still has a job, he'll be very happy with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like a good bill.
Any other member questions or discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Commissioner, thank you again for your work. And I know that, like you said, in the Commerce Committee, we had business and labor there to testify in support of the bill, which points to the leadership on this. I know that this has been a work in progress for a long time. So thank you for that, and also for your commitment to work on more or less a phase two of this with the outpatient pricing system. So thank you very much for your work on this. Representative Albright.
Members and Mr. Chair, we would appreciate a green light for go.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion. The House File 2235 be sent to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Last on the agenda, Representative Albright, you can stay there. We have House File 2236.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Because it missed deadline, has it already gone to rules? Because
2236?
Yes. 2235, I mean. Did that already go to rules?
2235 goes to rules after this. So the motion, the Chief Clerk's office has asked us to send everything to the final destination, which would be General Register. They will flag it and send it to rules.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I just caught that in the last one. In the past, they've always had to send them to rules.
Correct.
And the rules committee sent them to the General Register.
Correct. So although our motion is to the General Register, the Chief's Clerk office will put this in the possession of the Rules Committee first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright to House File 2236.
Mr. Chair, I would move 2236 before the committee this morning.
Representative Albright moves House File 2236 to the General Register.
Mr. Chair, I also have two author's amendments that I'd like to offer at this time.
Representative Albright, there's a couple amendments in here. Why don't you let me know which one you want to move first?
Mr. Chair, in order to get the bill in the shape that the author would request, that we undertake both the A1 and the A2.
Okay. Representative Albright moves the A1.
Mr. Chair and members, the A1 is recognizing some standing verbiage that has been typically put in other intergovernmental bills to clarify the communication between the agencies. And we spoke with Ms. Dyson about this, and if she wants to add any further clarification to that one, I'm certainly happy to allow her that opportunity.
If there's questions, Ms. Dyson would be happy to answer any of those. Any questions to put the A1 on and put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A1 is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I then would also ask that we move for the A2 amendment.
Representative Albright moves the A2 as an author's amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, the A2 amendment relates to page 10, lines 25 through 31. In light of the responsibilities for the commission, we felt it would be appropriate for the Met Council themselves to undertake the expenditure to take care of an introspection on their usage and also their facility for providing services to the Sebag County metro area. So we are removing that language.
Ms. Any questions on the A2 before we put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Seeing none, all in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted. Representative Albright, to your bill is amended.
Members, we have, over the course of the last several months, heard any number of ideas that would pertain to the reform of the Met Council. And as you have heard, obviously, from your constituents, as we've heard from any number of stakeholders, one of the first things that comes to mind is the governance structure of the committee itself. And undertaking a consideration of that and considering the myriad number of stakeholders that any of those proposals would put forth, we took a step back. And we started to think about what the most common denominator would be in light of the Sebag County metro area that they serve. And as we contemplated the mayors, the associations, the other governmental associations that would be certainly interested in being a participant to the Met Council, it came to mind that we have a ready and willing and very vocal opportunity to bring some oversight to the operations of the Met Council, and that would be the county commissioner boards that serve the citizens of each one of the seven counties. And so in the language that you see before you, one of the topics that we undertake is a reform of the Met Council governance. This does not reflect badly or upon a distraction from the MPO, which is required in order to receive federal appropriations for transportation. We are just changing the governance structure in terms of the type. So in the language that you see before you, what we are doing is we are proposing two commissioners nominated or elected by their peer group to serve in staggered terms based upon when they are nominated, as well as they are not to serve more than two consecutive terms in the capacity of a Met Council participant. In addition to that, it should be notable that if they are not reelected as a county commissioner, they obviously would not stand for reelection or reappointment to the Met Council board as well. So from a standpoint of governance, from a standpoint of transparency, from a transparent, from a perspective of accountability to the people they serve, and also for the sake of responsiveness to the people they serve, I think that that would stand in good stead for any number of reasons that we could reflect upon. Now, that being said, one of the observations is, why would not we include mayors? Why wouldn't we include city council members? And one of the things that we have to consider is the nature of small cities versus large cities and their availability to Met Council meetings, their availability to observe some of the issues that are going on in their own municipalities, but also particularly in some of the smaller towns, they have jobs to do during the day. And so their availability to take time away from those, not only for their city council meetings, and as my district would project, either Jordan, the townships, or in Prior Lake, they are very, very busy people, and they are trying to run their lives as well as run their cities. And not to say that they would not dedicate themselves wholeheartedly to a responsibility on the Met Council, But observing that they have people that are going into an election at as a county commissioner where they're with their eyes wide open, understanding that they will be nominated to other boards, other responsibilities over and above their initial responsibilities, broadly speaking, to be acting in the capacity of a county commissioner. So that being said, you can take a look at that. There are seven counties times two, that's 14. The governor would still have the opportunity to appoint the commissioner of the Met Council. That makes 15. And at any point there is a drop off, the commission or the county board that is removed or has a member that is not available, they would nominate a new one. That provision, as it is in the bill, would take place in 2018. So notwithstanding that provision, anything that you see in front of the council right now stays in place in contemplation of a new governorship of either party happening in 2018. The next piece that we talk about is the voting structure itself within the bill. And we oftentimes remark about the issue of a majority with one or two of the larger counties within the context of either Hennepin and Ramsey. We try to remove that by saying that in addition to one of the larger counties, they have to come alongside with the majority of the other counties exclusive of Hennepin and Ramsey, so that there is collaboration. And to a gentleman that I was speaking with this about, this really does reflect upon true bipartisanship amongst the seven counties to move forward on an advisory projection of any policy that they would recommend and or assert that other people contemplate as we move forward. I think the other provision that is in the bill, as you see before you today, is that we are establishing a Blue Ribbon Planning Commission. I think in most cases, an agency such as the Met Council, having been around as long as it has, certainly deserves at regular intervals to go through a soul searching or an introspection, and so we take account for that and establish a commission that is established not only from prior members to other councils of a similar ilk, but also current and contemporary members that would like an opportunity to speak into that reformation, that adjustment, or a reflection upon what is most right and necessary for the Met Council going forward as it pertains to the seven counties and for the metro area of Minnesota. That being said, I'm happy to stand for questions. I do have a couple of testifiers that I would like to call upon for their reflections upon the bill. And, Mr. Chair, I would ask for your discretion.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Why don't we move into a brief time of testimony? I have, at least on my list, I have Mr. Shetnin, Ms. Nauman, and Commissioner Gerlach. Welcome, Mr. Shetnin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Judd Shetnin. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak to this bill. We've had a lot of discussion related to council governance here over the past few months, and this bill adds another type of flavor to that discussion. To be consistent with what we've said on the other bills is, especially when you change the council's governance structure from the way it currently is provided today in statute, the administration would see this as an infringement on the governor's executive authority and does not support that provision related to changing the membership of the council to the seven county commissioners of the seven counties. Related to the Blue Ribbon Commission, we have had discussions with that. I participated in a discussion with Representative Albright about that earlier this year. There's a similar provision moving in the Senate. That is something that we may be a little bit more open to having that discussion related to the Blue Ribbon Commission in the Senate. It's a study that Senator Dibble is bringing forward. The piece that is very concerning to us, though, really relates to the making the development guide advisory in nature as well. One of the purposes of why the council was created and why we have regional governance is to make sure that large regional investments are being looked at in a regional perspective so that one community does not make a decision that has a negative impact on how these big, broad regional investments are being made or invested. Like a wastewater treatment facility, like a wastewater interceptor pipe, regional parks go beyond municipal boundaries. So if one community makes a decision and another community disagrees, how are these regional investments going to be interfered with one another? It also relates to how our transit system is operated. So the development guide aspect of this bill is really a thorny issue for us. It's something that we absolutely do not support, but related to the other provisions in this bill, we'll continue to have a conversation with Representative Albright related to the possibility of this study, but full-fledged governance restructure is something that we can't support as well, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Shetland, question for you. You said that you don't support the bill because it removes the ability for input from the regional governance, and you don't want one area to be able to have heavy input. My question to you is this. I represent a lot of cities on the terminal end of the seven county metro, and they feel they have no voice in this at all. And you and I have had that conversation again and again and again. I'm just wondering, how do you give me a message to bring to them? Because I've asked on numerous occasions, how do I best reflect this your point to the folks in, say, Watertown, who I met with last Tuesday, and they said they still have never seen their new Met Council rep, and I know it's early for that, but they never saw their old Met Council rep. You know, you talk about preserving the ability for those that are receiving service to make sure they've got a voice. Well, my folks have no voice in their estimation. So I'm just asking for you to give me something to take back to them.
Yep. Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I can assure you that I'll be speaking with our new council member to make sure that there is engagement out in your community and make sure that those folks have an opportunity to be heard. You and I had this conversation earlier, very early in the session, and you talked about the ghost, and the ghost is now not representing that district, and so our new council member will have an opportunity now to be able to come visit with you. I will be happy to come visit with you as well and make sure that those concerns are being addressed. What my point was earlier was making sure that large-scale regional investments are looked at as a regional, through a regional perspective. And that was the whole reason why the council and these regional services were put in statute for the council to bring forward through the Metro Development Guide. And I think it's working. But your point is that if your communities aren't being heard, then we need to do something about that. And so I will make sure I talk to the new council member, Barber, and make sure that we have that follow through with you and your communities, and I'm happy to speak with you again to see who we need to speak to as well, because the whole point is to make sure that that engagement is there, and that's an expectation of the council as well.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. Ms. Nauman.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to comment today. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We're an organization that represents cities throughout the seven county metropolitan area. I think I've spoken with other bills that have carried some similar provisions in front of your committee previously, but I do want to state that Metro Cities policies do oppose having local officials appointed to the Metropolitan Council, whether they be city or county officials. We did have a task force that looked at this issue a few years ago, and that task force was comprised of about 17 city officials, and the policy position that emerged from that task force was one of opposition due to the high potential for the incompatibility of offices between local and regional level officials. I will just state, with all due respect to the counties, that cities do believe that they are the primary constituency of the Metropolitan Council, so while we oppose having either city or county officials. We most definitely don't want to see county officials, as cities believe that they are the primary constituency, and that was noted in our task force report. With respect to the development guide being advisory, some of the concerns that I would raise are that, so Metro Cities, let me just say up front, supports very strongly, it's embedded throughout our policies, that there is a strong need for local engagement between the Metropolitan Council and local officials, and we support the council doing this with all of their policies and planning. The concerns that I'd have with respect to the regional or the development guide are that Metro City's policies do, on the other hand, recognize a regional system of government. We do recognize the need for regional services and planning that can be provided most effectively and cost efficiently at the regional level. So we would not want to do damage to those particular services and planning. So I would, we would express some concerns with that provision as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Commissioner Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And committee members, and before I begin, also on your list, there's somebody from Scott County that wasn't on your list, Claire Roebling, that I think wants to be added, if that's possible to do. Well, members, I've appeared before you when Representative Uglem had a bill dealing with a reform issue as well, so, and I don't want to be completely redundant. I will tell you that in looking at this in a broader perspective, you know, the Met Council was formed, of course, in the 1960s, and it was about a little over two decades, there was a major reform done in 1994, a major reconfiguration into what we have today. It's now been another couple of decades, so maybe it's time to take a look and modernize and update and really examine the governance structure, and is it serving us well? As I've stated before, we don't believe it is, and when I say we, I'm speaking here today formally for my Dakota County Board. We have passed a resolution that asks for reform to put elected officials on the Met Council to bring it closer to the local governments and not be the state agency it functions today. And also, informally, as you know, the suburban counties, the five suburban ring counties, have been meeting informally and just to discuss these issues and look at options, explore suggestions, and pull together some strategies about what can be done to improve the metropolitan regional governance. So, and I've participated in those and have spoke to many county commissioners in those five counties and feel like I have a pretty good feel for where they're coming from. What I'd like to do is specifically on this bill, on the proposal, I would say that the key here is whether it's county commissioners or city officials or some folks, the most important key that is important to us is the independence. The idea that the Metropolitan Council cannot function as a sole in the sole domain as a state agency under the purview of just the governor as it functions today. That it can't do that and expect collaboration and cooperation and meaningful results with all of the varied local governments of which comprise the metropolitan region. That model has been in effect for 20 years, and it's time to update that now and get a different model that is more independent and is more responsive and collaborative and cooperative with the metro governing entities that are out there. I think that this bill goes a long way towards accountability, because as I've mentioned before, we throw that term around a lot. But what exactly does accountability mean? And in our discussions with county commissioners in the five counties, we've decided that what that means is a broader constituency. If we want people to be accountable, we want them to have a varied group of people send them to this regional governance structure, debate and argue about the issues, and then stand up for their decisions and not just dictate from one individual in a hierarchy down, this is what it is. But this broader constituency is what's going to give us that greater accountability. That's what we mean by that. This bill has staggered terms, which is important. I think there's a lot of momentum now gaining for this whole notion of staggered terms that's important. And after two decades of experiencing the coterminous terms, where they are all coincide with the governor, and they tend to just go with the winds of the politics of who's occupying the governor's office, be they Republican or Democrat. But that is not a good way to operate. That does not give us consistency. It doesn't give us that that institutional memory that we need with the members of that board, and staggered terms is important, and this bill offers that. So that's a piece that we do support. The other items are that I wanted to talk about, well, the other item was mainly on the study, and that is that the Section 17, the Blue Ribbon Commission, and this, of course, if a decision is not made about what the ultimate structure is going to be during this legislative session that the governor can agree to and the legislature can agree to, then, of course, fallback position that the legislature often looks at is, okay, well, let's study this issue. We believe that the way this study group is structured is very fair, neutral, broad-based, and is a good approach to take. And we're very supportive of doing some kind of study. And I know the funding structure was just changed, and that's entirely, of course, under your purview. But it does need to be adequately funded in some mechanism so that it can be done properly, and that we can bring all the sides together, because any ultimate result then is going to come back to you, and I want it to be meaningful, you want it to be meaningful, so let's do it right and fund it and make it happen correctly so that you have all the information to go with. The last item I want to mention is that there's some critiques about, well, can county commissioners or city officials do this job? Number one is, do they have the time? Do they really? I mean, they're already doing jobs. Isn't this just another add-on that's going to make that impossible? I will tell you that county commissioners and city officials, city elected officials, oftentimes, all of us serve on a wide range of different committees. So just like legislators have various committees and policy areas, we do the same thing. We are already involved in Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, the SWIM Club as we call it, to handle all of those issues in the metropolitan area, the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District, the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board. The list goes on and on and on of joint powers agreements and collaboration to function as a region. Not with a parochial, narrow view, but with a broader regional perspective. We do that all the time, every day, and it's nothing new. So to say that it would be just too parochial for a city council member or a mayor or a county commissioner to serve on a regional governance body, that's just a red herring out there, and it's not accurate. It certainly can be done. You also need to change the thinking that, well, we're not just going to look at hopefully the result of a study is going to do some restructuring and look at this and say, it's not just what we have now and we're just going to swap out elected officials under the same model, but you look at the whole thing in restructuring. Is the Metropolitan Council really doing everything are they doing things they shouldn't be doing, or maybe things should be moved around? Are the county boards doing some things they should be doing? Can those things be structured to free up time to make it work better? There's a whole wide range of options that a study could uncover and come up with some very solid recommendations to make to you. So that is certainly not a real issue. So those are the things I wanted to leave you with. And if there's no questions, then that's all, and I will get out of here. Then it was lunchtime.
Thank you, Commissioner. If you could, in 30 seconds, which I know is tough because you're a former senator, but if you could go back to your House days. So I know that, part of the I know two former senators in one day, and one, this is going
to
be tough.
I have to get my robe and wig out.
So I know that your county, in conjunction with a few others, and due to some of the things that were happening at the federal level, decided that we do need to have elected officials on our regional authority governance body, and we're looking at other alternatives and maybe going out to Washington, D.C. Could you just talk about why that's necessary, and would this legislation that's in front of us potentially solve some of those issues?
Well, certainly. What I will tell you is that there was no nefarious backdoor plot to do anything. What it is it was county commissioners talking about options and putting ideas on the table and saying, well, what are we going to do? We can look at some legislation, maybe some legislators that are doing some things like this and many other bills that have been introduced. We should encourage these sorts of things. So there's a strategy. And another one is, what's going on with the makeup of the TAB, Transportation Advisory Board, and the Met Council? What does federal law say about how that's supposed to be constituted, and how has that changed over the decades? There have been some recent changes, and when we looked at that initially, we thought, maybe the Met Council doesn't really comply with this anymore because we don't have elected officials on the Met Council. And the Met Council might say, well, we have them on the TAB. Well, the TAB doesn't make the decision. So there's really some gray area disputes about really if we're constituted correctly. So four of the counties said, well, let's do some research. Let's talk to some people in Washington. Let's hire some folks to do this research and go out there and talk to some of in the administration, the federal administration, and talk to some legislators out there and find out options, strategies, suggestions. What can we do? What's the lay of the land? And to bring that stuff back to us. And of course, in the intervening time as this was going on, yeah, there was some media reports about it. I did an interview with the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and then also I think on Channel 5 it was, they want to know what's going on. So I just simply said that. I said, we're doing a little bit of research, we're trying to find out what's going on, and then we'll take actions after that. So that's what that is all about. I know it's more than 30 seconds, but yeah.
It's good for a former senator. Ms. Roebling, welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm Claire Roebling, and I'm the Communications and Legislative Coordinator for Scott County. And Commissioner Gerlach covered a lot of areas that are similar to our concerns. But Scott County has had an interest for quite some time in seeing elected officials serve on the Metropolitan Council. And I just want to make a few comments that are a bit different than Commissioner Gerlach's, but one of our residents in the county has been doing some research, and one of the things he recently came up with for a column in the newspaper pointed this out. The Met Council website says, the 17-member Metropolitan Council is a policy-making board. Elected officials and citizens share their expertise with the council on key advisory committees. That's how the council sees itself. Elected officials and citizens advise, whereas officials appointed by the governor make policy. Is that how it should be? With 4,200 employees and $1 billion annual operating budget, the Met Council is the fourth largest government in Minnesota. Yet it is accountable to no one but the governor. It is our belief in Scott County that policymaking should come from officials who are accountable to the people they represent. And it does go back to this whole issue that you just brought up, Mr. Chair, about what we call the Metropolitan Planning Organization, or MPO. And we believe that the federal code has changed over the years, and we need to look into whether or not, indeed, we are in compliance in the metropolitan area here as to whether or not our Met Council meets requirements, which we believe now state that they are to be made up of elected officials. And there was a provision that grandfathered this in the past, but when code changes were made in 2012, we believe that provision that said they would be grandfathered in was removed, and that's why we're looking at this right now. And so it could happen if there would be an interpretation that we're out of compliance, that we would have to change it. But that all has to be looked into yet. And so we also, you know, are excited about the commission opportunity and hope that gets moved forward. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. With that, we'll move into member questions and discussion. Representative Nelson, then Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I thought... what time do we have to be out of here? Are we going to get this done before we have to leave? I thought you said 12:30.
Yep. I've spoke with the chair that's coming in behind us, and we've got till 12:40-ish, 12:45.
Okay. I don't know if we're going to get done. Mr. Chair, number one, I have the A4 amendment that I'd like to offer.
Representative Nelson offers the A4.
And, Mr. Chair, what this does is it deals with some of my concerns of the bill as it's written. And I know Representative Albright presented me a copy of this bill to look at, and we haven't had a chance to talk about my concerns with it. But one of my concerns has to do with the way I read this is, number one, is that Hennepin and Ramsey County, the two largest counties, probably between the two of them, they have more population than the rest of the counties combined. They're basically being made second-class citizens. They're not going to have represent all the people in those counties aren't going to have equal representation. You know, the one person, one vote rule that we normally have, and why we when we redistrict so the districts are equally or relatively equal in size, so that everybody's represented equally. And the fact that they can't, you know, with their two votes or four votes, they would be outruled, and again, their citizens would then be funding stuff, paying for stuff where they don't have equal representation. And this goes at part of that. The other part about that voting in the subdivision 9 on page 3.6 goes at, if two members of the county don't vote the same, they basically, their votes are canceled out because they won't count as part of the majority. So I mean, Hennepin County could have one person vote one way, Ramsey County could have one person vote the other way. You know, and all the way through that, I think we'd be good at voting stuff. I mean, so this is some of the concerns I have with this. The part of the bill that I do agree with has to do with the Blue Ribbon Council. I think if we're going to look at making changes to the Metropolitan Council, I think we should do that first before we change the council. Like we kind of got the cart before the horse in this, because they're setting this up and they're setting up a Blue Ribbon Council to look at it, but they're already changing the makeup of the council as we go forward. There's numerous issues I have here with this bill, and like I said, that's why I'm bringing for the A4 amendment. I think we should go forward with the Blue Ribbon Council to look at changing it. I mean, we've seen many bills this session, different ways of changing the council. I think three or four that I've seen and read. It's almost like we're throwing mud at the wall and seeing which sticks. And so, Mr. Chair, that's I move the A4 amendment.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson, I certainly appreciate the conversation that we shared about the initial walkthrough of the bill, and we'll continue to work on this. I do have some comments in terms of the provisions that you are deleting in your A4 amendment. The first would be that Hennepin and Ramsey, for some suspicion, might be the underdogs or be relegated to a second-class city. I think to some extent the representations that are in the bill with regard to the voting structure really adhere to and recognize some of the responsiveness to the changing demographic studies that are apparent and we've seen in this committee before, in terms of people are moving away from the inner city and out towards the outer rings of the suburbs. And so we need to, in addition, as former Senator Gerlach, Commissioner Gerlach, recognizes in his comments, recognize that people are moving out to those other suburbs. And so we're trying to not appease, but to Representative Nash's concerns as well, recognize that there are needs that are moving out to the other suburbs that aren't represented. And for the sake of the current structure, I think that there is an unfair advantage given to Hennepin and Ramsey. To your extent, the voting itself between splitting the vote, that really goes to the sense of true bipartisanship that we want to embrace in the bill. It isn't a cherry-picking one over the other. This really does give every council, every county, and their commissioners an opportunity to send whom they feel most represents, and if they want to split the vote up between two of diametrically opposed viewpoints, that's their choosing, not as it would here to now a single person determining the whole committee structure that serves on the Met Council. To your points with regard to the structure of getting the cart before the horse, if you'll note in the provisions of the bill itself, the council itself is initiated with the final enactment of the bill and reports back to the legislature in 2016, whereas the change in the governance structure of the commission itself doesn't take place until 2018. So I would respectfully disagree with your point of getting the cart before the horse. We're taking the study, undertaking the study first, and to the extent that that is completed and we make modifications to whatever structure is voted forward in this bill or others, I think that is commensurate with good planning. So I would oppose the amendment.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, but the bill, to the last point, the bill prescribes how we're going to change the council before we make the study, even though we're not doing it till 2018. We're still, it's almost like we're predetermining what the study's going to say. And again, they're not letting the study go forward. And as to the splitting of the votes of the different counties, you could have every county split their votes, and you wouldn't be able to have a majority because they would all have split votes, and they have to have, as I read it here, for adoption, you'd have to have both members of each county vote the same way, and if they vote differently, then you're never going. They all voted differently, you'd never have a majority, and you basically hamstring the council, and they never make any decisions. And I don't think that's what we need to do with metropolitan governance. Again, these are my concerns, and that's why I brought forth the A4 amendment.
Any other member discussion to the A4?
Mr. Chair, very briefly, if I could.
Representative Nash.
As I'm sure Representative Albright was about to point out, with the one appointment by the governor, there wouldn't be necessarily a tie from Representative Nelson's concerns. There would be one extra appointed by the governor that could decide a tie vote.
Representative Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chair, the way I read the subdivision 9 on line 3.6 to 3.10, that if the members from the counties voted separately, their votes wouldn't count. They basically, so there would be no way to have a majority because their votes wouldn't count because they have to vote together to change things and move things forward. That's the way I read that, and maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way I read that. So I mean, even the governor, then we're giving the governor even more power because the governor's vote would be the only vote that would be for something, and the other ones don't count. Again, this is a problem with that, which is why I say we're getting the cart before the horse, is that we're not letting the Blue Ribbon Council decide what changes may be needed. And again, we're getting all of this. Those are my concerns.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. All in favor of the Nelson A4, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail. Any other member questions or discussions? Representative Mullery.
Real quickly, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out, I was going to speak, but Representative Nelson said everything, except when Commissioner Gerlach was in the House, we always sat together in two different committees for years, and he never spoke more than 20 seconds.
We usually House train well. Senate screws it up, usually. No, we appreciate everyone for coming in, Commissioner Gerlach, Mr. Shetland, Ms. Roebling. Thank you all for testimony, Ms. Nauman. Any other member questions or discussions? Seeing none, Representative Albright will give you quick final words.
As I've said in other committees, Mr. Chair, I know when to shut up and sell. So with that, members and Mr. Chair, I would appreciate a favorable vote as we move forward on this piece of legislation. Thank you for your audience today.
Thank you. With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 2236 be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say. Representative Nelson requests a roll call. We will take the roll. Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 2236 be referred to the General Register as amended.
Chair Sanders.
Aye.
Vice Chair Pugh.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Nope.
Representative Albright.
Aye.
Representative Fenton.
Aye.
Representative Halverson is excused. Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Mullery.
No.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Runbeck.
Aye.
Representative Seltzer.
No.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
No.
Thank you. There being nine ayes and five nays, the bill is referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, members, we are adjourned until tomorrow.